Inselmilkom. Jina, Karm Seraċino, mill-Malta Classics Association, nil-għakom għaldin il-xandira ta' veniment li seħ fis 19 ta' Marzu 2013. Dakinar, il-Festa ta' San Giusep, il-Malta Classics Association organizzat lecture publiku ġewwa Villa Bologna f'Ħattart. Ta' min jgħid li il-Malta Classics Association hija organizzazzjoni volontarja biex tippromuovi l-kultura u l-lingwi tal-Greċja u tar-Ruma tal-Qedem. Minn mindu twaqfet fl-2010, il-Malta Classics Association organizzat diversi lectures, korsijiet tal-Grek u tal-Latin, produzzjonijiet teatrali u anki publikat l-ewwel ktieb tagħha. Il-lecture li ħad isimgħu ingħata mill-professur Stephen Harrison. Dan huwa studjuż ta' fama internazzjonali importanti ħafna fil-kamp akademiku klassiku. Stephen Harrison huwa professur tal-letteratura Latina fl-Università ta' Oxford. Huwa wkoll fellow u tjuter tal-klassiċi fil-Kulleġġ Corpus Christi tal-istess università. Il-professur Harrison kien Malta għal ftit ġranet fuq stadina tad-Dipartiment tal-Klassiċi u Arkeoloġija fl-Università ta' Malta, fejn ta' sensiela ta' lectures fuq l-Eneide ta' Virgilju. Fil-fatt Harrison huwa meqjus awtorità fuq Virgilju. Iżda Harrison, il-professur Harrison, tinteressaħ ukoll ħafna ukoll l-istorja tal-wirt ta' tradizzjoni klassika tul is-sekli. U kif din intlaqet u ġiet adattata f'diversi aspetti tal-ħajja moderna. Id-diskors li ta' il-professur Harrison l-Malta Classics Association li ħad isimgħu dal-waqt kien dwar Ruma u Hollywood, li fih huwa tħaddet dwar ir-raġunijiet għala l-industrija taċ-ċinema f'Hollywood dejjem sabet ispirazzjoni fid-dinja ta' Ruma antika. Huwa kkonċentra fuq tliet films partikolari li huma Spartacus tad-direttur Stanley Kubrick li ħareġ fl-1960, The Fall of the Roman Empire li Anthony Mann dirija fl-1964 u naturalment Gladiator mir-reġista Ridley Scott li ħareġ fis-sena 2000 wara li parti sostanzjali minnu ġiet iffilmjata Malta. Waqt id-diskors tiegħu, Professur Harrison wera numru ta' sekwenzi minn dawn it-tliet films li ovvjament intom bħala semmija ma tistgħux taraw, imma li għall-inqas ħad isimgħuhom. Mela, Hollywood and Rome, lecture pubbliku minn Stephen Harrison, professur tal-letteratura Latina fl-Università ta' Oxford, organizzata mill-Malta Classics Association fis 19 ta' Marzu 2013, festa ta' San Giusep, Villa Bologna ġewwa Ħattart.
So, thank you, Carmel. Can you hear me? I don't really need a mic, but I've got one. So, thank you very much, Carmel, for that kind introduction. And thank you very much to Carmel and to Nick Vella for organizing this visit for me to Malta. It's my first visit to Malta. It's very exciting for me. I'm actually coming back later in the summer for a holiday. So it's a real pleasure to be with you in this beautiful place. And I'd like to thank Charlotte and Jasper for hosting this event today. It's a real pleasure to be in this lovely building. So as Carmel says, one of my interests is what we call classical reception, the way in which classics has been used in different ways in the modern era, and perhaps the most widespread way that classics has been used is in cinema. And this is especially true amongst young people. In my country, young people don't read anymore, but they do watch films. And that's an exaggeration, but I think young people are much happier with cinema as a form than with reading. And so I find they are very appreciative of the connections between classics and cinema. So the films that I want to talk about today are Spartacus. Who's seen Spartacus? Yeah. It's the same age as me, 1960. I will talk briefly about The Fall of the Roman Empire, which probably no one has seen, with Sophia Loren. No? Yes. Carmel has seen every film, but thank you. It was, as we say in English, a turkey, an unsuccessful film, but it's an important link between Spartacus and Gladiator. Who has seen Gladiator? Yes. Okay, good. Okay. So today I want to, with the help of the technology, thank you very much for organizing that, I want to show you a few clips from these movies about the Roman world, and perhaps to suggest why Hollywood was so interested in Rome. What could Rome offer Hollywood in the great age of Hollywood? Well, first of all, Rome could offer the opportunity to make spectacular films, to make films which were big and beautiful and used exotic locations. Here we have the opening of Spartacus, which is in North Africa. It also allowed you to use lots of violence. Many of the films about Rome are films about war. Spartacus has lots and lots of battles in it. I'm not going to show you any of the battle scenes, but you must take it from me that half the movie is a war movie. Okay. So Hollywood can offer spectacle, technicolor. Hollywood can offer violence. And Hollywood can offer sex. And although the movies that I'm going to show you don't have much sex in, talking about Rome allowed Hollywood to use sex and violence in a way that was not possible in normal films in Hollywood in this period. So because it's classics, it's okay. Because it's about the Roman world, you can use these elements which in other kinds of cinema are not possible. Indeed, one of the scenes I'm going to show you was cut out of the film Spartacus in 1960 and only restored in 1991. Now, from our perspective today, it's very tame. It's virtually harmless. But in 1960, this was dynamite. So let's think about why would America be interested in Rome in this period? The period I'm talking about is perhaps from 1950 onwards. Well, at that time, America was, in practical terms, America was a world empire. It was fighting wars first in Korea and then in Vietnam. But of course, at home, America could not be an empire. It always denied that it was an empire, and it still denies that it is an imperial power. But I think the realities of politics suggest that America is a global empire still. Now the last global empire until the Chinese catch up, which is not very long. And of course, back in the 1950s and 1960s, the major concern of international politics was the Cold War. Now, I'm old enough to remember the Cold War. When I grew up in the 1960s and 1970s, we all thought that the Russians would invade Europe and we'd all die with atomic bombs. And we have to remember that this was the time in which some of these movies were produced. So when there is talk about an evil empire, people probably remember that Ronald Reagan used that phrase about the Soviet Union. There's some idea, too, that the Romans are like the Russians, maybe. And also, interestingly, the Romans are like the British. It's very common for the bad characters in these films to be played by famous British actors. And the bad character in Spartacus, Crassus, is, of course, played by the greatest British actor of them all, Laurence Olivier, and we will see him in the scenes to follow. So I've given you a handout which has details on all these films. That's really to take away. And what I'm going to do now is to show you about a dozen clips from these films and comment on them afterwards. So time for clip one. Carmel, thank you. This is the beginning of the film Spartacus.
In the last century, before the birth of the new faith called Christianity, which was destined to overthrow the pagan tyranny of Rome and bring about a new society, the Roman Republic stood at the very center of the civilized world. Of all things fairest, sang the poet, first among cities and home of the gods is golden Rome. Yet even at the zenith of her pride and power, the Republic lay fatally stricken with a disease called human slavery. The age of the dictator was at hand, waiting in shadows for the event to bring it forth. In that same century, in the conquered Greek province of Thrace, an illiterate slave woman added to her master's wealth by giving birth to a son whom she named Spartacus. A proud, rebellious son who was sold to living death in the mines of Libya before his 13th birthday. There, under whip and chain and sun, he lived out his youth and his young manhood, dreaming the death of slavery 2,000 years before it finally would die.
No prizes for seeing that is Kirk Douglas, the great Kirk Douglas, in one of his greatest Hollywood movies. You also heard in the soundtrack that there is a considerable emphasis on slavery. Now, in 1960 in America, of course, slavery had been abolished for 95 years officially. Who's seen the movie Lincoln? Very good movie. I recommend it. But of course, the consequences of that in the South were still that black people, in effect, could not vote, and this was the time of the civil rights movement. And Spartacus, the novel on which Spartacus was based, was written by an American communist while he was in prison for being a communist, which in America was not a good idea in that time. And Spartacus is coming from quite a left-wing position, very left-wing for an American perspective. And one of the biggest fans of Spartacus in history was Karl Marx. Karl Marx said famously in a letter that Spartacus was one of the great heroes of history. So we can see that there's a lot of politics here. And in the film Spartacus, Spartacus makes friends with a black gladiator, Draba, whom he has to kill in the end. But that is a statement by the film about the freedom of black people. So this idea of slavery is important in the Roman Empire, but it's also important in America in 1960 because slavery, in effect, still exists for black people in the South in that they haven't got civil rights. Okay, now I want to take you on to the second scene I'm going to show you. And here we have Peter Ustinov, the great Russian-British actor. Peter Ustinov won a Best Supporting Actor Oscar for this film, and in this next speech you will see why. The thing to see is Peter Ustinov is the trainer, Batiatus, and he's the star of the new Spartacus on American TV, if anyone's seen that, much more violent and sexual than this. But Batiatus is the trainer of gladiators, and here we're about to see him speaking to the new gladiators coming into his school, one of whom is Kirk Douglas. And this is a wonderful speech, wonderful dialogue.
In spite of sickness and death, we will profit 11,000 sesterces.
Including your commission, of course.
Oh, no, sir. Without my commission.
Marcellus, there they are. They're a dirty-looking lot, but it's the best I can find.
No one else could have made so fine a choice.
Slaves, you have arrived at the gladiatorial school of Lentulus Batiatus. Here you will be trained by experts to fight in pairs to the death. Obviously, you won't be required to fight to the death here. That'll only be after you've been sold. And then for ladies and gentlemen of quality, those who appreciate a fine kill. The gladiator's like a stallion, must be pampered. You'll be oiled, bathed, shaved, massaged, taught to use your heads. A good body with a dull brain is as cheap as life itself. You'll be given your ceremonial cowders, Marcellus, please. There. Be proud of them. On certain special occasions, those of you who please me will even be given the companionship of a young lady. Approximately half our graduates live for 5, 10 years. Some of them even attain freedom and become trainers themselves. Marcellus. I congratulate you, and may fortune smile on most of you.
Ah, well, wasn't he wonderful? A really great actor. So, a gladiator is like a stallion. So a gladiator is strong, but is an animal, is not a human being. And one of the points about this movie is that the system of slavery treats people not like people. So it's a good kind of liberal thing. Hollywood movies are not always liberal, but this one is, partly why I like it. Okay, well, I mentioned earlier that the baddie of this film, Crassus, his real historical character, of course, is none other than Laurence Olivier. And we're about to see him meet the second hero. And the second hero of this film is the great Tony Curtis, as in Some Like It Hot and other great movies. And one thing you will see in this movie and in all three movies is a real attempt to be historically accurate. So when we see Tony Curtis, he has a notice around his neck which says who he is and what he can do. He's a slave. And that notice is in very good Latin. It was written by a professor, I think. And everywhere in the story, you will see beautiful costumes which are historically accurate. And what we're about to see actually takes place in a reproduction Roman villa at San Simeon in California. And this was the villa of the American newspaper proprietor William Randolph Hearst, or otherwise known as Citizen Kane. Is the model for Orson Welles' Citizen Kane. So everything you see is real. It's real American millionaire Roman villa. Okay, scene 3 from Spartacus.
Glabrous in attendance?
He awaits you in the antrium, sir.
Excellent. What have we here?
A gift from the governor of Sicily, sir.
Antoninus. Sicilian, age 26. Singer of songs. For whom did you practice this wondrous talent?
For the children of my master, whom I also taught the classics.
Classics, indeed. What position have we, I wonder, for a boy of such varied gifts? You shall be my body servant. Instruct him.
You shall be my body servant. I think we get the gist. And there is a strong... Crassus is described in this movie as bisexual, and one of the things that Romans do is that they sleep with anything on two legs. That's the idea of this movie. Slaves, by contrast, are monogamous and heterosexual. That's the kind of prejudice this movie has. Now I want to show you the scene that was cut out by the censor in 1960, and this is the scene in which Antoninus, Tony Curtis, is acting as body servant to Crassus, Laurence Olivier. It takes place in a very dark environment. Nothing naughty goes on, don't worry. San Giuseppe would approve. Yes. But this was thought to be naughty enough to be cut out by the censor, and that's because of the dialogue, which talks famously about eating oysters and eating snails, so being homosexual or heterosexual. But in 1960, Hollywood could not handle this kind of dialogue. And we'll see later that this, I call this the bad bathing scene. And the next scene that we'll look at is the good bathing scene. So this is the bad bathing scene. It's a kind of platonic dialogue between these two characters. If you know the works of Plato, you will see it's a kind of Plato dialogue.
Fetch a stool, Antoninus. In here with it. That will do. Do you steal, Antoninus?
No, master.
Do you lie?
Not if I can avoid it.
Have you ever dishonored the gods?
No, master.
Do you refrain from these vices out of respect for the moral virtues?
Yes, master.
Do you eat oysters?
When I have them, master.
Do you eat snails?
No, master.
Do you consider the eating of oysters to be moral and the eating of snails to be immoral?
No, master.
Of course not. It is all a matter of taste, isn't it?
Yes, master.
And taste is not the same as appetite, and therefore not a question of morals, is it?
It could be argued so, master.
My robe, Antoninus.
So this is a scene with no nudity, really, and only very harmless dialogue, but it was thought to be so dangerous in 1960 that it was cut out by the censor. And that was a great shame, because it's quite an important balancing scene with the next scene, the good bathing scene, as I call it. Now, this film was made by the young Stanley Kubrick, or rather, the young Stanley Kubrick took it over when Kirk Douglas sacked Anthony Mann as director. And this was the second time that Kirk Douglas and Kubrick had worked together. The first was The Paths of Glory, a very good First World War movie, black and white movie, which I recommend very much. And if you know the work of Kubrick, there are at least two things, that Kubrick is famous for. The first is wide-angled shots, big shots. We're not going to see any of them, but there's some wonderful battlefield shots in this movie. And the second thing is mirror scenes, that's to say, pairs of scenes which echo each other. So I've just shown you the bad bathing scene, and now I want to show you the good bathing scene, and this is where Spartacus is watching his girlfriend, Virinia, played by the beautiful Jean Simmons. And you can see this is good heterosexual bathing, which would appeal to all middle Americans. It's very kind of white picket fence, 2.5 children, as we will see.
To the mother that bore me, the father that taught me, to the god, to the blue woods and the purple shadows, I...
To blue shadows and purple woods.
Spartacus, you frightened me.
I'm sorry.
How long have you been there?
A little while.
Well, why didn't you say something?
You seem so happy, I didn't want to bother you.
I am happy. Spartacus, I've been trying to remember the song that Antoninus sang. Is it blue shadows and purple woods, or is it... purple woods and blue shadows, or what is it? Can
I
you remember?
Make love to me.
Spartacus, put me down.
I will. Oh! I don't care.
You got. Yes? You have to be gentle with me.
Why, darling?
I'm going to have a baby. Now put me down.
What?
A baby?
When?
So this is nice and heterosexual. They're going to have a baby. That's very nice for an American screen audience. Remember, these movies are aimed at a mainstream American screen audience. I always think that moment when she tells him she's going to have a baby, he kind of double takes. He's thinking about the college fees. So you can see this is another bathing scene. It's in the open, the sun is shining, it's heterosexual, it's a complete contrast with the previous bathing scene. And that's the kind of artistic quality that Kubrick's movies sometimes often have. His later movies are not so good, but this has it. All of it. Right, I'm now going to show you. So you must imagine at least 1 hour of battle in this film. I'm not going to show you any of the war scenes. They are wonderful. I'm not even going to show you the famous scene when everyone stands up and says, "I'm Spartacus." You can take that as read. Wonderful scene. Wonderfully parodied by Monty Python. I'm Brian and so's my wife. But I want to conclude with another pair of mirror scenes. And these are two scenes set outside the walls of Rome. In the first scene, Spartacus and Antoninus, Kirk Douglas and Tony Curtis, are sitting as prisoners outside the city. They have lost the battle. They've been defeated, and out comes Laurence Olivier as Crassus, and we have a scene which looks forward to the scene between Maximus and the Emperor in Gladiator. And one of the things I want to get across to you today is that the three films I want to talk about are closely related. That is to say, all the Gladiator material from Gladiator, pretty much, comes from Spartacus. But the historical plot of Gladiator, its setting in the time of Marcus Aurelius, the Roman politics, comes from the fall of the Roman Empire, the middle film, which I'm going to give you one shot from. So we need to think about films as being like literature. Films influence each other. If you're aware, say, of the films of Quentin Tarantino, he is someone who's always alluding back to previous films. And in our time, films have become a kind of literature. They've become very sophisticated. They've become very allusive. They look back to other films. And this was not really the case in the Hollywood of the 1950s and 60s. Okay, so I'm going to show you the first scene, wonderful scene again, with Laurence Olivier being really British, outside Rome.
Antoninus, the night passes slowly, doesn't it? Spartacus. You are he, aren't you? Gladiator. I'm Marcus Licinius Crassus. You must answer when I speak to you.
Great stuff, great stuff. Olivier is just wonderfully over the top there. Gladiator. "You must answer when I speak to you." Now we will see that that is picked up in the famous confrontation scene between Maximus and the Emperor in Gladiator. But note, I hope you notice the wonderful costumes again. The torque he's wearing around his neck, this is all absolutely authentic, real. Those of you who are classical archaeologists will recognize that these things are real. And a lot of research went into these films. As in the modern films, a lot of research goes into the modern films. They usually hire a professor and then ignore what they say. But at least they hire a professor. Not me. I'm open for offers. Yes. One of my friends worked on Gladiator. So now I want to show you my last scene from Spartacus. Now, in the historical story of Spartacus, Spartacus is killed in the last battle against the Romans. He does not survive. His men were famously crucified on the Via Appia, but not him. But in the version of the story that we find in the film, Spartacus is crucified. Now, that might put you in mind of another famous historical character who was crucified, and you would not be wrong. I think, who's the most famous person in history to be crucified? Not difficult, not in this country. And, of course, this is very interesting because the historical plot of Spartacus is set in 70 before Christ. That's to say, two generations before Jesus is born. So why does this movie want to get Christianity in? Well, of course, it's appealing to an American audience. America, in the 1950s and 60s, very Christian country, still quite Christian country compared to, say, Britain or Scandinavia. Not as Christian as Malta. Malta's very Christian. Yeah. So there is, again, a wish to suggest that Spartacus is a kind of Christ-like figure. I love this scene because it reminds me of American immigration. Now, what's happening in this last scene is that Potiatus, Peter Ustinov, the gladiator trainer, has now become a good character, and he is helping Virinia and her baby, who has now been born, to escape from the Romans. And this is the second scene outside Rome. But again, it's daytime, not nighttime. Although Spartacus is dying, there are positive aspects because his child has survived and his child will live into an era of freedom. So it's a kind of positive ending. And again, it's a mirror scene. It's a scene which self-consciously contrasts with the previous scene. Okay.
Identify yourselves, please.
Lentulus,
climb down, please, and identify yourselves.
I object to that tone. I object.
I've got my orders. Come down and identify yourselves, please.
I told you I'm Lentulus Potiatus, the Lannista from Capua. This, my sister-in-law.
Lady, please.
Traveling a child to Aquitania on a senatorial pass.
Take a look over the
bag. Not a word.
What did you say?
So what do we have here? If you take away the baby, we have a woman in a blue dress looking up at a man on a cross. Now, you don't need to be very expert in the history of Christianity to realize that this is the Madonna, and that's Jesus being represented in this film two generations before Jesus is born. And that appeals to an American Christian audience. But I do love the way in which Peter Ustinov is questioned by the Roman soldier. what is your business in the United States of America? Have you ever been a member of the Communist Party? Actually, they've taken that off now. You have to say you haven't been a terrorist. When I first started going to America, you still had to say that you had never been a member of the Communist Party. Which, of course, is relevant to this movie since it was written by communists, in effect. So you can see how many of these aspects are tuned to an American audience of its time. This is a complex and interesting film because, on the one hand, it's written for a conservative, middle-of-the-road, white picket fence, car-driving American public. On the other hand, it's a left-wing story, in essence, written by Hollywood left-wing intellectuals to make a successful Hollywood movie. And this is a very interesting mixture. And that's one of the reasons why I find it so fascinating. And so, from my academic point of view, this is what we call classical reception, the ways in which classics are received by later generations and appropriated, modified, changed to fit that later generation's context. And sometimes people say to me, shouldn't you be critical of these films because they change history, they make mistakes? And my answer to that is, I'm actually interested in the changes that they make because it's the changes that they make that indicate how and why things are appropriated and modified, and that's what I'm interested in. So, how does this become a Hollywood movie? How are things changed and modified for an American Christian audience? Very interesting. Okay, well now we're going to see just one shot from The Fall of the Roman Empire, not because I don't think it's a worthwhile film, I do, but because I want to get on to Gladiator quite fast. Now, The Fall of the Roman Empire was made in 1964. It was almost entirely shot on a huge wooden set on a hill outside Madrid. Basically, they did a deal with the Franco government to have lots and lots of soldiers and so on. Now, remember, this is the 1960s. There are no computers, really no commercial computers. There's no computer-generated imagery. You may remember that when Gladiator came out, it was famous for its use of CGI, computer-generated imagery. So everything you see in this film is real, or in the sense that it's constructed, at least, out of wood. And also, the costumes and the history is all very authentic, archaeologically. And I'm going to show you the scene where the mad emperor is triumphing, Roman triumph in the center of Rome. And what we have, essentially, is more or less a full-size replica of the Roman Forum. Now, if you've been to the Roman Forum, it's kind of smaller than you think, but it's still pretty large. And this film was very, very expensive. I think it cost $12 million, which in 1964 was a lot of money. Is that right? I think I'm going to put it on the handout. No, $20 million. $20 million was as big as it got in terms of budget in the 1960s. Of course, you can't really make a major Hollywood movie for less than $100 million nowadays. So I'm still working on my movie of the Aeneid. I just need $100 million. It's strange that this film did not succeed because it had some very fine actors in it. It had Stephen Boyd, who played Messala in Ben-Hur. Who's seen Ben-Hur? Great movie. Yes, Messala is the baddie in Ben-Hur, and he has black hair. In this movie, Stephen Boyd is the goodie, and he has blonde hair, because that's what Americans have. Okay. The leading lady is none other than the great Sophia Loren, who does not come from Malta, but from Naples, not very far away. So we can think of her as an honorary Maltese. She does look wonderful in this film. And you will see her observing the triumph as her brother, the emperor, goes through the streets. What I really want you to look at is the set. The set is absolutely fantastic. And for those of you who know the layout of the Forum, he kind of begins at the end where the Colosseum is now. and he goes up to the other end to the what's now the Museo Capitolino, the Capitoline Museum at the top. And you will see all the famous structures of the Roman Forum in AD 170, which is where we are, reconstructed. That cost a lot of money. I think they spent most of the budget on the set, actually, in this movie. And all the people are real people. None of them is computer generated. It's absolutely for real. So this, if Rome gave Hollywood spectacle, this is it. This is really it in terms of real people and real set. So that's all real set, and those are all real people. They're mostly soldiers on conscription from the Spanish army for, I don't know, one peseta a day or something. So it was made during the time when Franco's regime was cut off from the rest of Europe. It was kind of blacklist movie. So they got everything very cheap. But unfortunately, the movie still did not do very well. But this is the movie that supplies the historical plot for Gladiator. The historical plot for Gladiator is, as many of you will know, it's the reign of Marcus Aurelius, the great philosophic emperor, and he dies and is succeeded by his son, the mad emperor Commodus, whom we saw in the chariot. But of course, in the version of the film, there's also a good possible successor who is the soldier. And that character is played in Gladiator by Russell Crowe, as I'm sure you know. So here we have essentially a movie which examines good and bad emperors. What is it to be a good emperor? To be more democratic, maybe, to be more liberal. What is it to be a bad emperor? Well, being mad helps, but also having total neglect of the people. One of the ideas about Commodus in these movies is that he's completely detached from the Romans as a whole, whereas Russell Crowe is very much one of the boys. Okay, so I'm going to show you just a few clips from Gladiator. And at last I'm going to show you a war scene. And there's lots of good battle narrative in Gladiator. And of course, have any of you seen the film Alexander? Yeah. Well, Alexander has great battle scenes, but the dialogue is terrible. And Colin Farrell is a great action hero, but he can't give speeches. He just can't. It's not his thing. It's a great shame that Alexander was so unsuccessful. And one of my good colleagues in Oxford, Robin Lane Fox, was the advisor on that film. And some of you may know that he didn't want any money for the film, but his price to be in the to help with the film was to be in the first 15 of every cavalry charge that ended up in the film. Because he's a great rider. He rides to hounds, and that's what... Not many professors do that kind of thing nowadays. Robin is very unusual. He got his price. He is in the film. He had to wear a crash helmet and everything. But unfortunately, the film did not do very well. But the battle scenes in Alexandra are very good. And if you like battle scenes, movies about Rome and Greece are very good for that. So the battle scene I'm about to show you is Maximus, the Roman. Well, he's really Spanish, but he's a Roman, fighting against the Germans in the woods. And this is replicating traditional Roman ideas about the Germans being hairy barbarians who lived in the woods. And you'll see, they're hairy and they're in the woods. So that's underlining Roman traditional ideas. The wood that you will see belongs to the British National Trust, and it's in Surrey. And they do a lot of damage to it, so I hope they paid enough money. I'm a member of the National Trust, so I hope they paid enough money. You will see there's a lot of emphasis on military technology. This goes down very well with the main demographic for American movies. Most Hollywood movies are aimed at males between 15 and 35. And males between 15 and 35, so I'm told, like fighting and they like technology. So here we have fighting and technology. And it's quite impressive. Enjoy. So this is number one from Gladiator.
Atlet! 3 weeks from now, I will be harvesting my crops. Imagine where you will be, and it will be so. Hold the line. Stay with me. If you find yourself alone, riding in green fields with the sun on your face, do not be troubled, for you are in Elysium, and you're already dead. Brothers, what we do in life echoes in eternity.
Charge!
the idea, lots of violence. But you can see the very disciplined Romans with their nice metal shields all walking in a straight line, and the kind of big hairy Germans just running at them. It does really replicate the Romans' own propaganda, and that's very interesting because, of course, the way we learn about the Romans is what the Romans wrote about themselves, not what the Germans wrote about the Romans, unfortunately. And notice there's one for dog lovers here. Maximus's dog gets to feature in the charge, of course, ends up dead later, sadly. So again, that's appealing to a dog-owning public, which, of course, again, American ownership of dogs is very high outside major cities. So there you get real war and real spectacle. That is really wonderful spectacle. And Gladiator, I think, did win the Oscar for cinematography. It won 5 Oscars, including Best Film, and Russell Crowe as Best Actor. And that's another great speech. One of the things you find in these films is that Romans are good at speaking. And maybe that reflects something about the classical tradition, the idea of the tradition of Cicero, the tradition of great oratory. Right, now I'm going to show you the training school scene in this movie, which is clearly based on the training school scene in Spartacus. Instead of Peter Ustinov as Potiatus, we have the wonderful Oliver Reed in his very last movie role. He died on the set, I think, of about that time. Oh, right, on the way back, right. Right. Yes. Of course you will know this scene. Yes. Well, Oliver Reed was a great actor, but he must have had the world's best liver because he did drink a lot. And again, you will see there's a wonderful speech by him. I'm sure you all know this great scene. And it looks much more exotic than the previous scene because it's shot somewhere more like Africa, in Malta. And we have a special giraffe imported from Africa, you will see. But again, it's the great verbal style of Olive Reed. Plus you get, there's one for the girls, here you get a big line of very fit men with good pecs. It's like a beauty contest for men.
Come on, how long does it take to get into my own house? I am Proximo. I shall be closer to you for the next few days, which will be the last of your miserable lives, than that bitch of a mother that brought you screaming into this world. I did not pay good money for you for your company. I paid it so that I could profit from your death. And as your mother was there at your beginning, so I shall be there at your end. And when you die, and die you shall, your transition shall be to the sound of... Gladiators, I salute you.
Yes, wonderful. Short, but absolutely wonderful. Great. You could see what a great actor he was. So you can see exactly the same speech is transferred to a different kind of global environment, more exotic. A tougher, less polite speech than the speech of Peter Ustinov, and that, I think, is an indication of the 40 years that have passed between 1960 and 2000. Dialogue can be rougher and tougher in Hollywood now. And one of the themes of these films is globalization, because we did not invent globalization in the 21st century. Alexander invented it, and then the Romans reinvented it. And one of the points of these films is that Rome is a global power. And that's one of the points that allows us to think of Rome as being America or Russia or maybe China, that it has parallels in modern history. Now, as I mentioned earlier, one of the major things which was exciting about Gladiator in 2000 was its use of computer-generated imagery. And now I'm going to show you pretty much the same scene that I showed you from the fall of the Roman Empire. That's to say, the triumph of the Mad Emperor, this time played not by Christopher Plummer. The last one was Christopher Plummer, as in The Sound of Music, same guy. This one is Joaquin Phoenix, who I think plays very well in this movie. So here we have exactly the same triumph scene, and I'm going to try and stop it a couple of times because there are small details I would like to pick out. But basically, it's a fantastic visual achievement, and that happens through the means of computers. And CGI is absolutely wonderful for movies. You can do anything. Things like Lord of the Rings would certainly look very different without CGI. Okay. I'm going to ask you to stop a couple of times. Come on. Is it three? Yes, three. Stop briefly on that. Okay, those of you who are archaeologists might recognize that this opening shot of Rome is based on Mussolini's model of Rome from the Mostra Augustea. And we will see a couple of details in this sequence that remind us about fascism. You don't need reminding about fascism in this island. You had an experience during the war. And many of the people who worked on the early Hollywood movies, of course, were refugees. Many of them were Jewish. Many of them were refugees from fascism. So that's one of the things that's also tied up with Rome, how far. And remember that both Mussolini and Hitler viewed their regimes as new Romes, especially Mussolini. But if you've seen the famous model in Euroland in Rome, you will know that this comes from it. Right, and that might be a little bit fascist as well. Of course, it's the Roman legionary eagle blown up, but that reminds us this is a fascist symbol. Okay, we can play through now. I don't know whether you saw the face of the actor Derek Jacobi. It's in the middle. Now, Derek Jacobi famously played the liberal Emperor Claudius in I, Claudius, which was very big on British TV, and I'm sure you've had it here. And this is very clever, because in this movie he plays a liberal senator, and those of us who've seen I, Claudius know that he played a liberal emperor in that TV series. So that's another example of cross-referencing to another cinematic television experience. But also wanted to stop here because isn't that a fantastic prospect? There we have the Colosseum, of course, in all its glory, already nearly 100 years old at this point, but pretty splendid. And you might think there was something a bit Nuremberg rally about this, and again, you would be right, the imagery is fascist. Carmel tells me that the extras you saw are Maltese, so that's great. But of course, most of these people are not real people, they're images. It's fantastically, the CGI is very effective here. But it just shows what you can do with people and buildings and computers.
He enters Rome like a conquering hero.
Yep, so there is Derek Jacobi in the middle, and the emperor's nephew there, who's going to play an important role in the last scene that I'm going to show you. And now I want to move to that last scene, which is the most famous scene in Gladiator. Since I didn't give you the most famous scene in Spartacus, I feel I ought to give you the most famous scene in Gladiator. And this, of course, is where Maximus the hero, you will remember if you've seen the film, begins as a general. He is then disgraced politically by the emperor for no good reason. He becomes a gladiator. He then goes to gladiator school, as we saw, so like Kirk Douglas. And eventually he ends up fighting as an anonymous gladiator in the arena at Rome. And that, of course, is where he meets the emperor again. And I'm sure many people can do the dialogue from this next scene. Absolutely wonderful dialogue, I think. And again, do look at the CGI of the Colosseum. Really wonderful. So.
Drop your weapons. Gladiator, the Emperor has asked for you.
I'm at the Emperor's service.
Is well deserved, Spaniard. I don't think there's ever been a gladiator to match you.
As for this young man,
he insists you are Hector reborn.
Was it Hercules?
Why doesn't the hero reveal himself and tell us all your real name? You do have a name.
My name is Gladiator.
How dare you show your back to me? Slave! Will you remove your helmet and tell me your name?
My name is Maximus Decimus Meridius, commander of the armies of the North, general of the Felix Legions, loyal servant to the true emperor, Marcus Aurelius, father to a murdered son, husband to a murdered wife, and I will have my vengeance in this life or the next.
What a great speech. It doesn't take much. You don't need many words, but you need good words and a good actor. And Russell Crowe is a good actor and has done a pretty good series of movies, I think. So you can see that this is essentially based on the scene between Kirk Douglas and Laurence Olivier in Spartacus. Less dramatic, no slapping, no spitting, but equal impact, I think. The dialogue is very good. And the dignity of Maximus when he turns away. Great helmet, really great helmet. That's a realistic helmet. Gladiator helmets were very elaborate, but very well executed. So that brings me to the end of my presentation today. And there are really two things I would like to leave you with. One is the idea that these films are worth the attention of scholars and people interested in classics, because they provide a way in which classics is modified for later generations. And in some ways, what we all do in studying or teaching or reading classics in our own time is reception, because inevitably what we are doing is taking texts from the Romans or Greeks and reading them in our own time in the 21st century. And we must be reading them with a whole collection of ideas from our own time. And so I think we can look back at these films and say, why does this happen in America in 1960? Why does this happen in the year 2000? Maybe it's looking back on the Cold War, which is now over. And I think it's very important for those of us who are professional classicists not to say, they got it wrong, they made mistakes. Because, yes, they do deliberately alter things, but the interesting question is why? Why do they do this? And usually it's practical, they can't do it in the film, or they run out of money, or it's to do with genre, it's to do with the kind of film that they're trying to make. So for me, the question is always not what did they get wrong, but what did they change and why? What were the reasons? And the second thing I'd like to leave you with is that these are really great movies to watch. Some of them are quite long. Spartacus is over 3 hours. But then Kubrick is well known for making very long movies. Gladiator is a more commercial length, one of the reasons why it was very commercially successful. And I do recommend The Fall of the Roman Empire. It has some really great stuff in it. It was very unsuccessful at the time. I think it was competing with Cleopatra for the 1964 Oscars. Of course, another movie one could talk about in this context with Elizabeth Taylor. How do you compete with Burton and Taylor? It's very difficult. Even with Sophia Loren, you can't do it. So I just want to recommend these movies to you as things you can watch. They're all there on the internet, or you can buy them from Amazon or one of these film sites for a very small amount of money. And they are genuinely interesting reflections about the Roman world and worth our attention in the 21st century. Thank you very much.
Dear Professor, thank you for your delightful lecture. Now we can have some questions. Anyone would like to ask some questions, please?
What pronunciation of Latin is spoken?
That's very interesting. First of all, they try not to use Latin very much in the dialogue because there is an issue about pronunciation in that when you're making an international film that you hope will export all over the world, you don't want to tie yourself to an American pronunciation of Latin as opposed to an Italian one. And I'm trying to think if there is, apart from people's names, I don't think there is a moment in either film where there is actual Latin dialogue. Spartacus begins with a quotation from a poet, which is in fact Ausonius, late Roman poet from the end of the Roman Empire, but it's translated into English. Of course, in the old days, Latin was an international language. When Dr. Johnson went to Paris to meet Voltaire, they conversed in Latin and they understood each other. But now I think Latin quite often, when I go to different places and read out the Latin, it's quite interesting that my Latin will be different from... In Italy, I speak Latin differently from England because I connect to the Italian tradition. But I think I can't think of any moment in any of these three films where Latin is quoted apart from the names. I think that is because by the 1960s and after, the pronunciation of Latin, as I'm sure you well know, is an international matter of controversy. Of course, in Britain, it changed about the time of the First World War. I remember when I was a student in Oxford, Harold Macmillan, the Prime Minister, was the Chancellor of the university, and he spoke the most unbelievable pre-First World War Latin. He'd been at Eton in about 1910, and half his friends were killed in the First War. And he would say, when he was Chancellor, he would admit people to degrees. And in normal English Latin, he would say, admitto te, I admit you, auctoritate mea, by my authority, et totius universitatis, and of the whole university. And he'd say, admitto te, auctoritate mea, et totius universitatis, ad gradum magistri honoris causae. Wonderful. Well, he was such a great speaker. He was well into his 80s then. Wonderful time. So even in my country, there have been several movements on Latin. But that's a very interesting question. We see lots of Latin written, and the Latin is correct, unlike the Latin in the life of Brian, you remember. People called Romanes, they go the house. It's the wonderful scene with John Cleese, the centurion, teaching Brian Latin. And in many ways, the Life of Brian was the last Roman movie. I used to tell my students in the 80s and 90s that was the last Roman movie, and then they made Gladiator. And the number of applications of students to courses in classics in Britain went up quite dramatically, went up by about 10% the year after Gladiator. And I think these are good recruiting things for classics. I often talk about Roman films to school audiences in the UK, and it's very effective. partly, as I say, because young people like films and they don't like books, really. I have two sons who watch films and don't watch, read books much.
The Passion of the Christ.
The Passion of the Christ, this is true. And, of course, Mel Gibson is well known for making movies in entirely foreign languages.
Aramaic,
absolutely. And he did, what was the South American one he did? Thank you. And that is another approach. And but I think probably most people would agree there are a lot of risks in that English is the international language and Latin or Aramaic is not. But it was a very interesting attempt, I think.
On people's question about pronunciation of Latin.
Yep.
How was this question? I think it was Sir Maurice Borah who jokingly said that the Romans spoke Latin with an English accent.
Well, one of our problems is we know something about how some of the vowel sounds, about how some of the consonants were pronounced, because we get transliteration into Greek. So, for example, we know that many of the C's were a hard sound because in Greek they're transliterated to kappa, to K. And we know that the V, was pronounced soft because in Greek, as you know, it's transliterated O-U, W, like some other languages. So there are some things we know how the Romans pronounce, but we don't really know exactly how the vowels sounded. We know if they were short or long, but we don't know whether it's E or I, for example. And I don't know how we're ever going to find out without recordings of Romans speaking.
I just wanted to mention that in the US, I, Claudius, was extremely popular.
Good.
As well. Yes. There were many, many people watching it.
I remember watching it at school. I was in my teens then, and I was at a boarding school, and I would go down to my classics master's house, and we would have soup, and we would watch I, Claudius. And it has lasted very well. I bought it on DVD quite recently, and apart from the sets, which were very cheap, the dialogue is excellent, and the actors are absolutely fantastic. I mean, Sean Phillips as Livia is wonderful, and the young John Hurt as Caligula, Derek Jacobi as Claudius, it's a wonderful cast. And again, I can thoroughly recommend it. And for the younger people, Spartacus Blood and Sand is very interesting. There's a lot of sex and a lot of violence, and what they do in the first series is basically they make a whole series about Potiatus, the trainer. But it's actually very interesting, and he's played by a very good actor, the British actor John Hannah, who's extremely good. But I have to warn you, there's lots of sex. And that is a genuine view of how the Romans behaved with their slaves. And it's true, if you... there's one scene where and have you also had the Rome series, the HBO Rome series?
Yeah.
So you remember the scene in which the Mark Antony character says, "I'm not going to get up until I've effed someone." I won't say the word in this polite place, but and that's actually not just a modern approach. That's actually quite realistic as to what you could do in a Roman household. If you were the master of a household, you could have sex with anyone in the household, male, female, slave, free. Well, probably not your children, but everyone else. And that's something really repulsive about the Romans that we're just beginning to realize. So again, that goes back to the kind of sex and violence thing, which of course is good in the cinema because it gets people into the cinema. But it's also historically realistic.
My question is a bit according to nature. On the classics, I have a problem trying to encourage
students, modern contemporary students, weaned on these audiovisual media to do the intensive amount of reading necessary to become fluent in the languages themselves. You seem to have a lot of experience in this field. What would you recommend? What insight would you give us?
Well, it's very important. I mean, I'm lucky in some ways in that the students I teach in Oxford, almost all of them have Latin from high school. Half of them have Greek still. The same is true in Cambridge. But in most other university classics departments in the UK, most of the students do not have Latin or Greek. And we find actually that courses, I haven't yet been able to teach a course on Roman film in Oxford. I would like to, but my problem is I need to go and do a master's on film studies. I feel a fraud doing it at university level. But almost all universities outside Oxford and Cambridge will have courses in Roman film. And that's the way that they interest the students in the subject. And then they give them interesting texts. So, for example, you might move from Fellini's Satyricon to reading Petronius, a text which appeals to a modern audience because it's a kind of novel, and it's about food and sex and all those things. So there are texts which tie up quite neatly. Or, for example, the movie Troy, you can take that and you can point out that most of it is from the Iliad, but there's a little bit from Virgil at the end. Remember, Aeneas gets to leave Troy. Now, of course, then you're inviting them to read these texts in translation, and if they like them, then the next stage is to try and get them interested in the language. And though I don't have to do this myself, because I teach at Oxford where most of my students have Latin already, I know that my colleagues and my students, my former students in other universities, are quite successful at that. But you have to have, so the films to get them in through the door, then you transfer them to texts in translation which are like the films, and then you motivate them saying, look, there's all this great literature, why don't you learn the language? But it is difficult, and I'm not sure how well I would do myself, because for so many years now I have been lucky to teach students who have Latin. Though their Latin is less good than it was 25 years ago. We have to give them a complete refreshment course on Latin when they come to Oxford, because even from the great schools they don't really know Latin grammar as we did 20, 30 years ago. It's not the fault of the schools, it's the fault of the curriculum, the 1988 curriculum changes. So it's tough, but many people do that. And in America, of course, this is one of the main ways of getting people into classics, that and mythology, the famous mythology courses. But I think if you can get people interested in what the Romans were really like, and I think these films give you a good impression of what it was like to live under the Roman Empire, and if they like that, they can find out more. And in the end, if they really like that, they will want to learn Latin. But it's a long road, and I'm not the best person to talk about it because I'm lucky to work in a university where we have 120 students a year, 110 of whom know Latin in classics. That's a fantastic thing. And I know that that's unique. I work in Copenhagen and in Denmark. They have precisely this problem. And again, I've given something like this talk in Denmark, and it does appeal to the students, and then they come back and they learn Latin. So I think you've got to get them interested in the subject matter. Why study the Romans? Why not study Islam or Chinese culture? You've got to like it, really. But I think this is a good way of opening up things that young people might like about the Romans. Who doesn't like sex and violence when you're 17? Or even older, maybe.
Thank you again, Professor Harrison.
Pleasure.
And also to those who contributed.
Yeah. And again, I would like to thank our hosts for this fantastic location. It's been really a great experience for me to come here. And thank you all for churning out on the Festa di San Giuseppe, which is very nice to be here on one of the great days of the island. Thank you.
Għadkom kem smajtu Rome and Hollywood, lekċe pubbliku moti minn Stephen Harrison, professur tal-letteratura latina, Università ta' Oxford, lill-Malta Classics Association.